Today we spoke with David McNamara, the CEO of Carry On, a 92-year-old charity that provides housing and welfare support to veterans and their families. David served for 14 years in the Australian Army, beginning as a private and working his way to retire as an officer, and he has a wealth of experience and knowledge in the veteran sector. In this episode, we will discuss the meaning and impact of Anzac Day, the challenges and needs of veterans in the modern era, and the amazing work that Carry On does to help them. Stay tuned for an insightful and inspiring conversation with David.
David McNamara, welcome to the Coffin Bond podcast. We've known each other for just over 4 years now. Looking at my LinkedIn profile, I am a honoured pro bono director of Carry On, where I met you, where you are the CEO. We do get along very well. I do do your report every year and give you a clean bill of health that we should keep you. So it's, and thus I'm honored to have you as a podcast guest today, especially this time of the year, having just, celebrated and, Anzac Day last Thursday. I was actually at the game, Essendon Collingwood as well. But we celebrated Anzac Day, I wanted to talk about, both Anzac Day. You are a retired serviceman, retired officer. I'm not. I think you did 25 plus years in the service, David.
You're giving me way too much credit. It was 14.
There you go. Okay.
You might be confusing me with our immediate past chair, Kyle.
Yeah, who was 24. I know. He did 24. That's right. So, but, I also want to then talk about Carry On and the importance of what Anzac Day means to veterans. For some, it's very important. For others, it's quite traumatic as well. But what it actually means for veterans, and then what Carry On does for veterans, because we do have a lot of veterans in need as well. So, but David, can I actually start with just a bit of your background prior to joining Carry On and your service, if that's okay?
Sure. I started off as a soldier in 1978 as a private soldier, and was promoted to corporal and sent to the Royal Military College on the staff there. And it was there that I was identified by some of my senior officers that perhaps I should entertain going to the Officer Cadet School at Portsea, which I did, obviously. And I graduated from there in June of 1985. And was allocated to medical corps. And through your normal series of postings and family demands, I got out in 1992. So, all up around about just short of 14 years. And, after that, I've been in business management, business development and business building, at a state and national level, until I joined Carry On. And that was in various franchises, Shaver Shop, Cleanmate St George, Cash Converters, all at state and national level as a franchise manager or as a business development manager. I came into Carry On after just over 10 years in the security industry, where I was the last role was the CEO of a national group. That was both electronics and guarding. And one of the things I introduced in that scenario was recruiting soldiers as best I could into the security industry. And it's a great industry for a lot of the guys who don't have the extended education. And since joining Carry On in 2019, so I'm now in my sixth year, I've been about the process of reinventing, along with the board, and modernising, if you like, Carry On's approach to supporting veterans.
Can we actually talk about that just before we go into Anzac Day, if it's okay, David? It's Carry On is a 92-year-old charity. It's let's start talking about why Carry On was formed, how it was formed, who it was formed by, but also then if we have a look at Carry On and how it's changed and morphed into what it is today. You know, we've spoken before, your 14 years of service was actually during peacetime, but if we have a look at, say, for example, the last 20 years or more, probably the last 25 years, anyone who has been enlisted in the military service has they haven't seen peacetime. There's always been, you know, our immediate past president, Kyle, he started in peacetime, but he did four tours. Jordan, who served as well, who works with us, you know, he did one tour over in Iraq as well. So can we talk about why Carry On was formed, how it morphed during peacetime, and where it is today?
I would love to. Carry On was founded, as you said, on the 12th of July, 1932. So it's only a handful of years younger than the RSL and, say, Legacy, who are the two major veteran support organisations in the country. It was formed by William F. Hawkins, who was an officer in the First World War, and he saw his former soldiers really struggling during the Depression. And of course, there were no welfare systems, state or federal, in Australia. At that time, we haven't even introduced income tax. So that's how long ago it was. And William got his former officers together and they pooled their resources and started delivering food packages onto the doorsteps of their former soldiers. And they did this for two reasons. There was no recognition or tagging, branding, if you like, of where that food parcel had come from. Their motto was to do good by stealth, because they didn't want the recognition. It wasn't about them. It was about their soldiers. And one of the reasons they adopted that motto was to protect the dignity and privacy of their fellow veterans. And by doing that, they created what was called the Carry On Club in that day. And it was an invitation-only club. So you had to be invited to become a member of the club. And you had an obligation then to serve veterans from the First World War. That continued until the 1940s, and of course we had the Second World War come about, 1939, 1945, and in 1948 they opened a home called Hurlingham House, which was for the orphans of veterans, and also, how do you put this nicely, the wayward children of veterans who were no longer able to live at home.
I think you put that very nicely, David.
So they supported those children through their education and obviously provided them with housing and that sort of thing in Hurlingham House. That ran until about 1962 when it was handed back to the state. For obvious reasons, there were no more children of World War II veterans. They'd all grown into being adults. Following that, Hurlingham House became a home for unwed mothers. And the unique thing about that was that they were one of the few organisations in the country that encouraged the mothers to keep their children. One of the great shames about our history is the forced adoption policies of the 50s and 60s that we hear something about with the stolen generation conversation with the Indigenous people. But the same thing applied, the same rules applied to all of the population, not just the Indigenous population. And I don't know how many people went through that home, but the home really was set up for either wives or girlfriends of veterans. And of course, we were going through a big change, a big social change in our community, in the Western, in all of Western civilization, in that women were getting far more freedom. And, of course, there's consequences that come with that. And we had a lot more single mother pregnancies. The home ran until 1973. At the end of the Vietnam War, they closed the home altogether. And the home was then sold off as funds to look at building retirement villages, essentially for Vietnam veterans, or provide housing for Vietnam veterans. And the first village was built in Mildura in 1978. You might think Mildura is a bit of a strange place to go, but if you think back to World War I and even to World War II to some extent, returning veterans were honoured and they were given land grants or development grants to buy homes and establish farms and all that sort of thing. Of course, with the Vietnam era, they were shunned. Not only by the population, but by the government to a large extent as well. So Carry On again stepped into the fold and started building these villages. As a result, we now have villages in Bendigo, Ballarat. There's two villages in Ballarat. Noor Lane in Geelong, in Noble Park in the metropolitan area. Again, there's two villages there, and in Rosebud as well. So we're spread across the state, providing housing for now 114 veterans and their families.
David, can I ask can I ask you a question there? Just because you'd have more of an understanding of this than me, and I actually am asking the question because I don't know the answer, but I used to spend a lot of my youth, we had de facto grandparents who lived in Horsham, and we would go up for school holidays and would spend time in Horsham. And I remember as you're driving through Ballarat, you had the Avenue of Honour there. You had all the trees with the names of fallen soldiers besides those trees. And of course, if you go into where I live in Kew or a lot of suburbs, they have memorials for fallen soldiers as well. So where do you think the difference went from, you know, soldiers coming back from World War One and World War Two, who certainly suffered traumatic stress, post-traumatic stress, not necessarily wasn't diagnosed as post-traumatic stress back then. I think it was called shell shock after World War One. But it was so from that perspective, soldiers were still looked after and brought back as part of the society. But say from Vietnam, or Vietnam especially, soldiers were shunned, you know, after Vietnam was, I suppose it was one of the first wars that was on television as well. So, and, you know, in colour on television. How do you think that adversely affected returned servicemen's mental health? Whereas their fathers might have come back from World War II and were classed, say, as heroes, and these Vietnam vets come back and just looked down upon, shouted at, spat at, et cetera. So can you explain what your thought process might be in respect to the mental health and the adverse effects of that? Because that's where Carry On comes in, helping those soldiers as well.
Absolutely. And just tying it back into Anzac Day, it's our peak season, so to speak. We put the whole team on alert about a month out. But coming back to the mental health issues, whatever name you want to give it, it doesn't really matter. Every soldier that has served in a theatre of war has to be affected mental health-wise. The Vietnam guys, of course, it was a very unpopular war. Wasn't even declared a war. It was a policing action and a training action initially. And we've all seen the footage of how they were treated when they came back, you know, buckets of red paint thrown over them, spat on when they were doing Anzac Day marches or even just returning from Vietnam themselves, and absolutely no recognition whatsoever. That must have had a huge impact on our Vietnam veterans. And it even stayed, the military was treated with not quite disdain, but it was almost a tolerance that we had to have it and we'll put up with it right through my service in the peacetime. I remember Gulf War Mark I, 1990, off the top of my head. I was in a supermarket in Tasmania. I was in uniform. I was going home. I was doing the bread and milk one, as you do when you're going home. And I had a woman have a go at me in the supermarket, suggesting, you know, we were baby killers and all the usual rhetoric that came with that sort of abuse. And I was taken aback by it, I must admit. And my response to her was kind of interesting. I said to her, if you were in a small little unit next door to a very powerful neighbour who was continually throwing rocks and bombs at you and coming in and harming your family in very, very bad ways, would you expect the rest of the world or the rest of your street just to ignore that and do nothing about it? So I had to try and bring it back to a personal level to help people understand. That was my immediate response. And she sort of stood there stunned and just turned and walked off. I don't think she expected me to reply. And you know me pretty well. I don't back away from a discussion at any time. I guess that feeling or that sense that came particularly with the Vietnam veterans of isolation, of unwantedness, of non-recognition, compounded everything that went together. Then we look at Iraq, also an unpopular war. If you look at it from the point of view that was going on at the time, there was a lot of political argy-bargy around it, which transferred into the civilian population. excuse me. As I mentioned, Iraq Mark I was the so-called invasion of Iraq. excuse me. Where it was really about the protection of Kuwait. And there was a lot of misinformation and disinformation, to use modern day terms, around why the US went in. And turning people's minds around that. At the time, the US was 90% oil efficient, self-sufficient. And the Security Council at the UN had agreed that if Iraq didn't abide by its policies, then the action would be taken. So at a meeting of the Security Council, the Western allies, if you like, Britain, Australia, US, excuse me, would agree to go ahead. And it was those that held the leases for the oil mining in Iraq, the French, the Russians and the Chinese, that blocked the UN from going into Iraq. So it was that that caused the US to take its own action. And of course, as an ally, we went with it. That wasn't sold that way, though, within Australia and the politics. And a lot of the initial people who served in Iraq, personal opinion only, had the same sort of negativity shown towards them as those from Vietnam had. It was almost this hatred's too strong a word, but this mistrust of what the Australian Army was involved in. Thinking that through, and then we went into, obviously, Afghanistan following the Russians' departure. That turned into a bit of a disaster for us, not through the efforts of the Australian military, I might add. But there was also East Timor, Rwanda, and other peacekeeping options that we were involved in that led to Australian deaths as well. So we became
military. David, it's interesting you say that one of our clients is a retired major, and he was the very last Australian soldier to leave Afghanistan on the big, what are the big planes? And they Hercules? It's still called Hercules, but or whatever they
still,
are.
Still calling Hercs, yeah.
Yeah, so
he could have been on anything.
Yeah, so he was the very last person, and he's told us the story, and we've seen it, and it's a very powerful story. And he was devastated because there were people there that he had worked with, the Australian government had worked with, that he had employed, who did really great stuff for the Australian Army, the US Army, etc., working with them, to try and get stuff done, that he had to leave behind. And that traumatized him. He had to leave people behind that he regarded as his friends and couldn't get them on board. And him to be that last person, the devastation that he went through of just having to abandon these people that did so much to help was quite horrendous. I mean, he's running his own business now. He's doing okay. You know, financially, he's really good. He's quite an entrepreneur. But you know, it took a toll on him. His marriage broke down. There's a whole range of things that occurred as a result. And I think that's not that he uses Carry On service, but I think that's where a lot of people don't understand why Carry On provide 40,000 nights accommodation to homeless veterans. And you know, so what we have to do to actually do that. So that's the part where a lot of people, and it's not just providing accommodations, providing so many other things as well, which sure, the public don't know about.
Yeah, one of the things that we, I guess, don't advertise, we obviously push the housing side, is that welfare support. We spend on average $250,000, $300,000 a year in supporting veterans, maybe 400 veterans every year. And it can be anything. And one of the great things about the board that I have that you're part of, Tony, is that you don't put any constraints on me on how, where I spend that money. And that has such a huge impact because a lot of the other veteran organisations, I won't mention them, are limited by their own constitutions on where they can spend the money, and I've got total freedom here. So I've done everything from fix people's cars so that they can keep their job and go to work, to orthodontic work on their children, because the child is in a situation where the veteran may well be in a psych ward or receiving treatment in a hospital somewhere and needs to support the family in some way, but just doesn't have the financial capacity. Lately, though, the focus has been on keeping people in their homes or assisting them to find a home. And in those situations, we're paying bonds and rental advances and rental arrears and doing whatever we can to focus on our core product, which is keeping veterans with a safe roof over their head. Now, that spend can even be repairing their own homes, where if the house has become unlivable, let's call it a plumbing issue, where the hot water service may have broken down, there may be blockages in piping and whatever, and the family's in a state of distress because they don't have the financial capacity to do what's needed to do, and they're at risk of not only a breakdown within the family, but actually losing their home.
David, I think there's something else to add to that as well, is that we know, and if this statistic is wrong, please correct me, but we know that veterans, there's seven times more veteran suicides than what there is in just the normal population. And I believe the vast majority of those are males in that. And a lot of times it's because they've lost their dignity. They can't support their family. They want to. They are suffering trauma. They don't see any other way out, and they lose their dignity. And one of the things that I love about Carry On, I'm very passionate about when I talk to Carry On to people, is that we actually help them get their own dignity back. And as a result of that, you know, if you didn't help that veteran get his car fixed so he could keep his job, all of a sudden there's no money. All of a sudden there's potential homelessness, not just of that veteran, but of family as well. But you allowed that veteran to be able to retain their job, to be able to have some dignity. And what I've found is that then, and because the people that work with you, David, you know, your team are just sensational. The amount of empathy they have for the veterans means the veterans do not feel ashamed in coming forward and asking for help. And I think that's one of the greatest things of Carry On that I've said, that I've witnessed.
One of the mantras that we have within the current team is that no veteran goes away without hope. And when you lose that hope and that sense of purpose in your life, it doesn't matter whether you're a veteran or any other one, and particularly for males where they can't provide for their family, they lose all confidence in themselves and it becomes an incredible spiral, and it doesn't take long before you end up with the worst possible result, and that's a veteran taking their life or a male taking their life. A lot of people don't understand that, and I'm getting a little bit into stats here, I know, but 85% of marriage separations are caused by a financial failure, be that loss of a job, loss of a business, perhaps a gambling addiction, any number of things where the family becomes destitute. And the veteran then loses all self-esteem because he can no longer provide for his family. And quite often it's the female in the relationship that will end the relationship because of that inability to provide for the family. They'll go and look elsewhere or find that they're better off on the welfare system than what their current or former partner can provide, which is incredibly sad. Now, with 85% of all family separations going that way, and then 85% of those suicides across the countries, and I'm saying males in general, it's not just veterans, but it is 4.5 times higher amongst veterans compared to their age cohort in the general population. When we get to that stage, we're looking at 3,000 men a year taking their lives in this country. And why or how that happens in such an affluent society is beyond me. We've got to be better at doing this. I know there's a lot of talk at the moment around domestic violence and the 28 women that have sadly lost their lives to former partners, but I've can almost guarantee you, you can trace that back to a significant financial loss at some stage. And Tony, this is your ballpark. You're heavily involved in that financial area, and you know the impacts that can have on a family. So we've got 85% of family breakdowns caused by financial, not by any other means. And then we've got 85% of all suicides, or 3,000 people, men in this country, committing suicide. 28 women killed by their partners so far this year. Well, I don't take anything away from the people that are pushing that barrow, but when we've got at the same time around about 700 men who have ended their lives and we're doing nothing about it at a state, federal level, it's a real shame. 4.5 times more likely as a veteran to commit suicide as their civilian cohorts for veterans. You can understand why the Royal Commission was enacted last year or 2 years ago now. So hopefully we'll get some good outcomes out of that that'll help help us help them.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the great things too there is what we talk about is hope as well, you know, and it's those statistics are so sad, especially when you consider we have one of the best social security safety net systems in the world. Whether it be for those single mothers, whether it be for veterans, whether it be for unemployed, or whether it be for retirees, we actually do have a very good social, social security network that's available. From that perspective, if we move forward and we start looking about Anzac Day, Anzac Day, we see the Veterans March, we see them, we had Kyle Tyrrell at the football with us on Wednesday night giving a talk to a whole lot of our clients, you know, courtesy of the Herald Sun, who helped us there as well with the box, just in respect to, he told some stories about, you know, being in service and young men, in this case it was an 18 and 21 year old, who had to make an on-the-spot, decision which could have been life-threatening for them, could have also killed some innocent civilians if they went another way. They had to make those decisions on the spot. Anzac Day can be a celebration and it can also be very triggering. And as you said, Carry On are on high alert in the week leading into Anzac Day. Can you give us a bit more of an understanding of Anzac Day from a veteran's perspective, David?
I'll give them a personal one first, if that's okay. Even though I was in a peacetime army, I lost two classmates through training deaths in this country. We lose about 15 soldiers a year in training accidents around the country, which, again, I think is intentionally kept pretty quiet. So even for veterans like me, who never served in a theatre of war, and I guess the biggest danger I faced was the annual inter-service football carnival playing against the Navy. That was the biggest danger I was in. But being a little more sensible about it, even for people like me, it's a time of reflection. The first people that come to mind are those guys that were in my class at Portsea that have died in training accidents in service. So it's not just about the war dead. Just training in the military is a dangerous occupation. For many. For some people, it and you mentioned us being on high alert, it all starts probably a fortnight before Anzac Day, the same for Remembrance Day, the same for Christmas, and within 14 days of a veteran's birthday. Very interesting stat, that one. Significant dates in a veteran's life are trigger points. It might be their birthday, it might be their wedding anniversary, and I guess it is for the rest of the population as well. And then when we get to Anzac Day, you can get such a variety of responses. A lot of people very proud, a lot of people very relieved that they're able to express their service and be heard. And for me this year, I had no official duties for the first time in a long time. And I was actually able to stand among the crowd. I didn't even bother wearing my service medals. Because I just wanted to be one of the mass and to listen to these people and see their faces. There was a lot of servicemen in the crowd as well, to be honest, but their families and their extended families that were there to support them and support every other veteran around them was just it's such a moving experience. It's more moving to me to be in amongst that crowd than it is to be part of the official ceremonies. But we've got guys that have spoken to us who will get contacted by a family member. And they'll tell us that Dad gets triggered by Anzac Day. What do we do? Take him away, turn off the television, go for a little holiday out in the bush, whatever it may be. But just acknowledge that it's a time for him. He's going to deal with it in his way. There is no universal way of dealing with Anzac Day. For me, it is a time of pride, but it's also very, very much a time of reflection.
Yeah, it's one of the things, and I'll end it on this post, on this. I was at the Anzac Day game with my older son, passionate Essendon supporters, and it is, David, it is so moving when the last post is played and you have the minute silence. 94,000 people, you know, of two football teams that do have some feral supporters, being both Essendon yeah. and Collingwood. I'd suggest Collingwood's the worst, but we won't go there. But it's 94,000 people standing, all of them taking off their hats if they're wearing hats. The emotion that is there, the emotion I felt of just watching the absolute respect, it was wonderful to see. It really was. And there's a lot of veterans there in the crowd as well. But it was moving to see the respect that, you know, I've never said the closest I ever got was, you know, being in the Air Force cadets, you know, so basically you just learn to march every week and polish your shoes. That was basically it. But, you know, I actually felt emotional. Maybe I felt emotional because of my connection with Carry On. But I just loved the respect that everyone was showing for the fallen veterans.
I don't know if there's anywhere else in the world where you get 100,000 people, roughly, standing in absolute silence for a minute. You can literally hear someone shuffle a foot.
You can.
In amongst 100,000 people. And it is, it's just spine tingling. And as you say, it is a sign of respect. And it's for all who have served, not just those who died. But everyone who has served this nation in a uniform. A veteran today we classify as anybody who's spent a day in a uniform. That's changed through the various times where a veteran, when I served, was somebody who had served in a theatre of war. Excuse me. And now it's anybody who's spent a day in the uniform, and I think that is the correct way of doing it because, as I mentioned, just training in the military is extremely demanding and dangerous.
Yep. David, I just want to sincerely thank you. As I said, we've become friends over the last 4 years that I've been involved with Carry On. I want to thank you for all the work that you do and the leadership you have shown your team and the work that they all do as well, Carry On, because there are, as I said, there's 40,000 nights accommodation provided to homeless veterans and their family and so much more that Carry On actually do for the greater community as well. And so I want to thank you. I know our listeners will thank you as well. And let's continue moving forward and helping those who have always served us as well. So thank you for your time today, David.
Thanks, Tony. Absolute pleasure.
The Coffin Bond Podcast is a product from Coffin Bond & Co., which we are an authorised representative of Cairn Financial. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal or tax advice. The hosts of the Coffin Bond Podcast are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decision, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from the podcast. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Coffin Bond website, or you can find resources on the ASIC website and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Coffin Bond and Co. and the hosts of the Coffin Bond podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of the country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.